card and pay on the go, enjoying the freedom from price surging during high demand times. You can also call for a cab at 613-546-2222 any time of day or night for comfortable and speedy transportation. Serving Kingston since 1939, Modern Taxi proudly supports local radio and the Queens community. It is your number one service for fast local transportation. Learn more at moderncitytaxi.ca.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC, 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. We're at COP30, the UN Climate Summit. This is Democracy Now!
I leave to Brasilia certain that my negotiators will achieve the best result that a COP can ever offer to planet Earth.
As climate negotiations continue here in Belém, Brazil, we'll speak to Sonia Guajajara, Brazil's first Indigenous Peoples Minister.
We are expecting the recognition of indigenous territories and the demarcation of these territories as a climate policy, one of the most efficient solutions to confront the climate crisis.
We will also look at how climate disasters have displaced 250 million people over the past decade. That's nearly 70,000 people a day. Then, is the Amazon rainforest being pushed beyond the tipping point? We'll speak with world-renowned Brazilian climatologist Carlos Nobre. All that and more coming up. To Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's military has killed at least 32 Palestinians in a wave of attacks that once again violated the October ceasefire deal with Hamas. Among the dead are at least 10 people, including an entire family, killed when Israel bombed a building sheltering displaced Palestinians in Gaza City's Zeitoun neighborhood. Israel said it launched the attacks after its soldiers came under fire. Hamas rejected the claim and noted Israel said none of its troops were wounded in the alleged attack. In Khan Yunis, family and friends held funerals earlier today for victims of Israeli attacks on southern Gaza.
They say there's a ceasefire. Where is this ceasefire they're talking about? Where are the guarantors of the ceasefire? Every day, 10, 15, 20 martyrs die. We wake up to martyrs, and we go to sleep to martyrs. And they say there's a ceasefire. Unfortunately, there is no ceasefire.
According to Al Jazeera, Israel's violated the ceasefire agreement at least 393 times since October 10th. Meanwhile, the charity Save the Children reports explosive weapons caused a record number of child deaths and injuries last year when nearly 12,000 children were killed or wounded in conflicts worldwide. It's the highest toll since records began in 2006, driven largely by Israel's more than two-year assault on Gaza, where more than 20,000 children have been killed, an average of one child per hour dead since October 2023. Syria's government's denounced a visit by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Syrian territory occupied for months by Israeli forces. The territory extends Israel's grip on the occupied Golan Heights. Syria's UN ambassador called Netanyahu's visit with Israeli soldiers a, quote, provocative tour which epitomizes Israel's ongoing aggression against Syria and its people, unquote. Meanwhile, an investigation by the Guardians found Israeli forces used cluster munitions that are widely banned under international law during its recent 13-month war in Lebanon. Photos published by The Guardian show remnants of two different types of Israeli cluster munitions found in three areas of southern Lebanon left devastated by Israeli attacks that have killed almost 4,000 people. The weapons are banned by 124 states that signed the Convention on Cluster Munitions, though Israel and the United States are not signatories. Russia launched a wave of missile and drone attacks on Ukraine Wednesday that killed at least 26 people, including three children. 93 others were wounded in the attacks, many of which targeted the western city of Ternopil, where missiles struck residential high-rise buildings. This is Oksana Kobel, the mother of a man who disappeared behind a wall of flames triggered by the Russian strikes.
My son is still in the apartment on the ninth floor. I talked to him before the explosions. That's it. He said, "Mom, everything will be fine. Don't worry." After this, I tried calling and couldn't reach him. I still know nothing.
Russia's latest attacks came as Axios reported U.S. and Russian officials quietly drafted a plan to end the war in Ukraine that would see Kyiv agree to surrender territory to Russia while cutting the size of Ukraine's armed forces. European officials pushed back against the plan, with France's foreign minister declaring, quote, "peace cannot be a capitulation." Meanwhile, Ukrainian lawmakers have fired two government ministers accused of taking part in a $100 million kickback scheme within the state-owned nuclear power company. President Trump signed a bill Wednesday compelling the Justice Department to release files from its investigation into the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. This comes after a near unanimous vote in the House and Senate ordering the DOJ to release the Epstein files. Attorney General Pam Bondi confirmed the DOJ will release the files within 30 days, but hinted the Justice Department may cite ongoing investigations or other reasons to hold back material. On Wednesday, a Republican effort to censure the Democratic delegate from the Virgin Islands, Stacey Plaskett, failed on the House floor. Documents from Epstein's estate released last week show Plaskett was exchanging texts with Epstein during a 2019 congressional hearing. Meanwhile, former Harvard president, former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, announced he's stepping down from commitments at Harvard and from the board of OpenAI after documents showed he continued to stay in touch with Jeffrey Epstein long after Epstein's 2008 sex trafficking conviction. Emails show Summers called Epstein his wingman and asked for advice on pursuing a sexual relationship with a much younger woman he called his mentee. Harvard has opened an investigation into Summers' actions. Hundreds of protesters took to the streets of Charlotte, North Carolina, Wednesday as Border Patrol agents continued to target Latinx communities, with over 250 immigrants reportedly arrested in recent days. This is Renee Tillett, a resident of Fort Mill, South Carolina, who joined the protests.
I feel it's important that we're out here, not sitting at home on our butts, quiet about what's going on. If you're not seeing something and saying something, you're complicit. I do not want to be complicit. What's going on here is illegal, it's warrantless, and people are getting picked up without proper identification, without warrants, and that is wrong. Doesn't matter who you are, that is wrong. We need to support our immigrants. We love our immigrants here in Charlotte.
This week, the Border Patrol expanded its North Carolina operations to include the heavily Democratic Research Triangle region, which includes Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill. Meanwhile, in Chicago, new data reported by the Chicago Tribune finds 97% of immigrants detained in the Trump administration's Operation Midway Blitz had no criminal conviction, according to federal court records. The Justice Department admitted Wednesday members of a grand jury never voted on the final criminal indictment against former FBI Director James Comey. The admission came as a federal judge in Virginia grilled Trump's hand-picked interim U.S. attorney, Lindsey Halligan, his former private attorney, over her procedural missteps, which many legal scholars say could result in her losing her bar license. Comey's lawyers have asked the court to dismiss his case on the grounds he's the target of a vindictive prosecution led by President Trump. In Florida, a man who joined the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol has been arrested on multiple charges that he sexually abused children. 44-year-old Andrew Paul Johnson pleaded not guilty to charges he molested a child as young as 11 years old. He joins a growing number of Capitol rioters who face new legal problems after they were pardoned by President Trump on Trump's first day back in office. The House of Representatives voted unanimously Wednesday to rescind a provision of the recently passed spending bill that would allow 8 Republican senators to personally sue the government for up to $1 million each if their phone records were seized as part of Special Counsel Jack Smith's investigation into the January 6th attack. Maryland Democrat Congressmember Jamie Raskin called the measure one of the most blatantly corrupt provisions for political self-dealing and the plunder of public resources ever proposed in Congress, unquote. It's not clear whether the bill to repeal the language will get a vote in the Senate. President Trump set to meet with New York City Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani at the White House Friday. Trump announced the meeting in a post on social media, calling Mamdani a communist. During the mayoral campaign, Trump had backed Mamdani's opponent, the disgraced former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, and repeatedly taunted Mamdani and threatened to deport him. Mamdani was born in Uganda and is a naturalized U.S. citizen. Mamdani's team had reportedly reached out to President Trump for the meeting. Here in Belém, Brazil, at COP30, a big issue emerging in the climate negotiations is whether countries will agree to a roadmap to transition away from fossil fuels. Now more than 80 countries, including Germany, Kenya, and Britain, are backing the proposal, but that's less than half of all countries attending the summit. This is Harjeet Singh, a member of the Fossil Fuel Treaty Initiative, who joined protests here at COP30 on Wednesday.
We want this particular COP30 to deliver a roadmap on fossil fuel phase out, to have a just transition plan so that we can all move away from fossil fuels and go more and more towards renewable energy. But the fossil fuel lobbyists are not allowing us to do that. Developed countries who are responsible for the climate crisis, they are not providing money. And without climate finance, we cannot protect our people. We cannot move away from fossil fuels.
Meanwhile, Turkey has emerged as the host of next year's COP31 climate summit, which will be held in the Mediterranean port city of Antalya, while Australia is set to lead the conference's negotiations. We'll have more from the UN climate summit here in Belém, Brazil, after headlines. And the Trump administration is proposing to significantly weaken protections under the Endangered Species Act with new rules that would allow for more oil drilling, logging, and mining in habitats for endangered species in the U.S. One of the proposed rules would enable the government to consider economic factors before deciding whether to list a species as endangered. Another rule would reduce the requirements for other federal agencies to consult with wildlife agencies on whether their actions could harm critical habitats. Jane Davenport, a senior attorney at Defenders of Wildlife, said the new rules could, quote, accelerate the extinction crisis we face today, unquote. An investigation by the Montana Free Press the Endangered Species Act has prevented 291 species from going extinct since it was passed in 1973. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit, COP30, in the Brazilian city of Belém, the gateway to the Amazon. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We begin today's show with rising calls by the United Nations to enact stronger protections for refugees and migrants forcibly displaced by climate disasters. In a new report, the UN's High Commissioner for Refugees estimates about 250 million people, predominantly in the global south, have been forced from their homes in the last decade due to deadly droughts, storms, floods, and extreme heat. That's more than 67,000 displacements a day. Many of these populations have faced repeated displacement due to war and extreme poverty, with UN experts saying 3 in 4 of those who've been uprooted now live in countries where communities are vulnerable to, quote, high to extreme exposure to climate-related dangers. In countries like Chad, refugee camps are likely to become uninhabitable by 2050 as extreme weather worsens, according to the UN. This comes as wealthier global north nations, which are disproportionately responsible for the climate crisis, have intensified their crackdown on migrants and climate refugees fleeing compounding humanitarian crises. At the U.S.-Mexico border, many of these migrants come from regions devastated by the climate crisis and destructive industries, including mining, driven by foreign powers.
On Wednesday, Democracy Now! Spoke to Edwin Josue Castellanos López, Guatemala's Vice Minister of Natural Resources and Climate Change, about Guatemala's role in ensuring the United States respects the human rights of migrant communities.
It is definitely a very complex situation, and we are just trying to work as much as possible with the U.S. government to make sure that they treat our citizens in the best way possible. It is difficult because they are, of course, interested in making sure that no more people go to the U.S., but we need to find a midway solution. We need to make sure that our people have the opportunities that they need. Many of these migrants are probably related to climate issues, but of course the main issue is always poverty, lack of opportunities, and climate change is basically exacerbating this problem.
That was Guatemala's Vice Minister of Natural Resources and Climate Change speaking to Democracy Now!'s Maria Inez Taracena. For more, we're joined by Nikki Reich, Director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Center for International Environmental Law. We want to talk about climate refugees around the world. But first, you are a leader in these negotiations and understanding what's going on. If you can explain, what are the sticking points at this point? It's unusual that the president of the country, President Lula, has come back to the climate summit at this early point. What are they negotiating over? And what is stopping them from moving forward? People may be shocked that at a climate summit, some of the countries are raising the issue of trans people. What does that have to do with climate change? But give us a broad overview.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you generally for your commitment to independent journalism, which is so critical in this moment. I'd say in the last 24 hours, we've seen an intensification of negotiations between states, largely behind closed doors, around what are really the big ticket items here, and arguably the big ticket items at every COP: finance, fossil fuels, and forests. So this is about the drivers of the climate crisis and the resources and finance needed to not only address mitigation of those drivers, but to respond to adaptation needs to help communities that are suffering disproportionately from this crisis and to deliver reparation for loss and damage. So those issues are front and center and are highly contentious because this is a justice package that's being negotiated here. A just transition can't move forward without adequate financing from public sources, without creating new debt for the countries that are really on the front lines of this crisis. So the big polluters need to phase out and pay up, and those are some of the issues that are at the center of the debates now.
And the fact that this issue of the definition of men and women is being raised at a climate summit, is that just being thrown in to really muck up the works and not arrive at a final resolution?
We've seen no end to the kind of procedural tactics that some countries will use to really derail the talks and avoid a phase out of the fossil fuel era, to avoid responsibility for the contribution of large polluters to and the biggest fossil fuel producers to this crisis. And we're seeing the weaponization of issues, attacks on human rights, including on the very notion of gender, pushback on references to law and legal obligation that are really shocking, but are a part and parcel of a global trend towards regression away from the basic dignity and respect for human rights of communities around the world, including of indigenous peoples, who we've seen in full force here at this COP in the Amazon.
Well, Nikki, as you mentioned, one of the key issues here, as indeed at every COP, is of fossil fuels. And now there's been a push by more than 80 countries to formulate a roadmap to phase out fossil fuels. The countries include Germany, the UK, Sweden, Ireland, and Kenya. Of course, Saudi Arabia and Russia have consistently over the years objected to coming up with such a roadmap, and the U.S. is simply absent. So if you could comment on that, the absence of the U.S. and what this push means by more than 80 countries.
Sure. Well, I think the fact that we see 80 countries speaking out about the need for a roadmap away from fossil fuels is a testament to the clarity of the science, the law, and the effectiveness of political pressure and the movement for climate justice. This issue is front and center, and undeniably, we cannot solve the climate crisis without ending the fossil fuel era, without tackling its root causes. So we see countries making those statements, but we need to go beyond political declarations. And that's why it's so important that we have leadership from countries like Colombia, a producing country, fossil fuel producer in the global south, that's committed now to hosting the first international conference on fossil fuel phase out outside of these halls, precisely because we see this continued procedural obstructionism from those countries that have a vested interest in the current status quo of fossil fuel dependence. We've seen them pull out all the procedural stops to really derail the talks here, as you said.
And of course, it's Brazil. It's taking place in Brazil, another oil-rich country. And the significance of that and what the president, Lula, both Lula and Petro are targets of President Trump, what Lula is committed to right now, what he's willing to do and what not.
It's a great point, because we saw just weeks before this COP opened that there was an approval of new licenses for offshore oil and gas at the mouth of the Amazon, right offshore. And so there are contradictions here. Unless we halt oil and gas extraction, we can't fight this crisis. But we see leadership from countries like Colombia and others that are committed to pursuing real concrete action, not just declarations here, but actually taking steps to phase out 1.5 in line with equity, beginning by halting expansion of fossil fuels and charting a pathway that provides resources to bring the rest of the world along.
I mean, I guess the crucial question is, when countries as powerful and indeed the largest historic emitter, the United States, right, are absent, on top of which the world's largest oil exporter, Saudi Arabia, and the largest present emitter, China, yeah, if these countries aren't willing to go in and agree to what the terms are of negotiating a roadmap, it's not even a final document, a roadmap to the phasing out of fossil fuels, what incentive do other countries have to sign on?
Well, countries have an incentive because the future is not fossil. They know that, like Colombia, as a fossil fuel producing country, recognizes that its own economic interests and its people are not don't lie with fossil fuels. And so they have options to go outside of this process, where we see the same obstructionist countries blocking progress decade after decade. And so that's why they're hosting a conference and working behind initiatives like the Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty, a fossil fuel treaty that could actually bring a coalition of the willing countries together to start and build from there. Because actually transitioning away from fossil fuels and taking the lead is in the benefit of those countries and their populations. It's actually an upside.
Let's talk about climate refugees. Mm-hmm. This is your specialty. Talk about the crisis in the world today. The hundreds of millions of people who are fleeing their countries because of a climate-related issue, and the countries they're fleeing to, much more responsible for climate change, bringing down the gates.
Yes. I mean, I think the statistics on the numbers of people who are being displaced by climate-driven disaster are one of the most visible and visceral reminders of the reality and severity of the climate crisis. And the fact that this is not abstract. This is about real lives. It's about survival. It's about human rights and dignity, and ultimately about justice. So this is also a reminder of two things. One, that we cannot tackle climate change without addressing its root causes, and that we absolutely need to provide finance to those countries where they're suffering disproportionately the impacts of climate change, but have not contributed to it. So developed countries need to pay up, get that adaptation finance to those countries, and support communities to build resilience and stay in their homes. And when they do have to migrate due to floods, droughts, extreme weather, heat waves, that they are received with dignity and their human rights are respected. That is utterly critical, and the law requires it. The International Court of Justice, the highest court in the world, has pronounced that. The principle of non-refoulement applies. That means that countries cannot send people back to places where they would be at grave risk of danger, including from climate harm. So this is a reminder that what we don't need is a militarized response. We know that climate impacts compound the stressors and impacts from conflict and other violent crises. And instead of a closing of ranks, we need actually a stepping up of respect for rights and finance to the country so that they can build their resilience to resist the impacts of climate change around the world.
And in fact, this report only, is that correct, speaks about refugees as opposed to internally displaced people displaced within their own borders, which I imagine would be a larger number.
It's my understanding that the bulk of these climate-induced migrants are actually internally displaced. And so that the impacts, it's in many ways a myth that the impacts are falling first and foremost on the developed world, because actually the bulk of this migration is happening within countries and between developing countries that are already facing many stressors, including from conflict and resource constraints. So we need to step up the commitments to supporting those who are only going to grow in number as the climate crisis worsens, unless there is concrete action here to address the root causes, fossil fuels, deforestation. We need to phase them out, to stop cutting trees down, and to build up finance commitments in concrete ways to tackle this at the source. Otherwise, we're just going to see more devastation and damage.
So, Nikki, before we conclude, just on another topic, the landmark decision taken by the International Court of Justice in July, the obligations of states under international law on the question of climate change.
This is the first COP after a historic decision, as you say, by the world's highest court on what countries' climate obligations are, to rest any argument that the biggest polluters don't have a legal obligation. Climate action is not an opinion. It's a legal obligation that countries have a duty under multiple sources of law, not just these climate conventions, but customary law, human rights law, to prevent climate harm and to step up action to protect human rights in the face of climate impacts. And that law is the yardstick for progress here, not what they promised last year or the year before. They will be measured against those legal obligations. And we're seeing that come into the set a new benchmark for these talks. It's high time to end the accountability gap. That ambition gap is not just about stepping up promises and pledges, but committing to action in line with law and science.
Nikki Reich is director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Center for International Environmental Law. Thanks so much, Nikki, for joining us. Coming up, as climate negotiations continue here in Belém, Brazil, we speak to Sonia Guajajara, Brazil's first Indigenous Peoples Minister. Stay with us.
Recoge solo tus ideas, levanta apaga tu mirada para todo lo que venga.
Me está llamando.
El día que amanece lento. Recoge solo tus ideas, levanta apaga tu mirada para todo lo que venga.
Me está llamando.
Semilla que va germinando, paciencia que el enfoque llega. El tiempo que flota en el aire, las horas al viento
me
se entregan. Semilla que va germinando, paciencia que el enfoque llega. El tiempo que flota en el aire y el viento se entrega.
Me está llamando.
De a poco te zapas del miedo, un dedo tras otro lo sueltan. En tu pecho una llamarada que por dentro quema.
Me está llamando.
De a poco te zapas del miedo. Un dedo tras otro lo suelta. En tu pecho una llamada que todo lo quema.
Me está
llamando. Y me está llamando. Óyelo.
Me está llamando.
Un fuego que todo lo quema. Un fuego que todo lo quema. Responde que te está llamando. Responde que te está llamando. Un fuego que por donde quema. Un fuego que todo lo quema. Un fuego que todo lo quema. Un fuego que todo lo quema.
Maku Sound System at our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit. That's COP30 in the Brazilian city of Belém, the gateway to the Amazon. On Wednesday, I sat down with Brazil's First Minister of Indigenous Peoples, Sonia Guajajara. Democracy Now! Last spoke to her in 2023 when the UAE hosted the climate talks in Dubai. We're now in her home country. We're here with Brazil's first minister of indigenous peoples, lifelong leader of the Brazilian indigenous rights movement, a member of the Guajajara community, whose traditional homeland sits in the northeast of Brazil. It was established, the minister of indigenous peoples, under President Lula in 2023. Today, the minister Guajajara, is here in Belém, and we're in the last days of this conference. It's an honor to speak to you again. Minister Guajajara, what are you hoping to get out of COP30?
I think we got an important result. There is the biggest participation of indigenous peoples in all COP history. Because participation is already an important result to guarantee protagonism and advocacy. But now for the second week, in this final phase, we are expecting the recognition of indigenous territories and the demarcation of these territories as a climate policy, one of the most efficient solutions to confront the climate crisis.
On Friday, indigenous people like yourself stopped the climate summit, saying that their rights weren't being respected. They had a flotilla. They also just blockaded the entrance to COP30. What were your thoughts about that?
Por isso que foi importante essa COP acontecer aqui no Brasil.
This is why it was important that this conference happened here in Brazil, in the Amazon, after being realized and organized in three countries that did not allow democratic manifestation. And Brazil, as a democratic country, understand that this is important. Social society can and should protest. And we were able to guarantee their participation also inside of the COP. We guarantee the participation in the Blue Zone of 400 indigenous representatives chosen by its own organization. So the indigenous movement inside the COP, it is represented. But as COP is also not only the Blue Zone, we also have indigenous representatives participating in all the other spaces, such as the Green Zone. We have a space called the Circles People, where we have like a daily program. We also have the COP Village Aldeia COP that received 3,500 indigenous peoples lodged there, and we also have programming there for them. So we estimate that at least 5,000 indigenous peoples were in the city from all over the world participating in all of these spaces and also in this People Summit. So it is here allowed that every people can bring their own demands and they can protest since they respect also the rules of the United Nations.
So there are more indigenous people, almost 1,000 registered at this COP, than there have ever been. But there are also over 1,600 fossil fuel lobbyists. What effect does that have?
Então, essa foi uma das grandes motivações.
So this is exactly one of the biggest motivations that we had to try to guarantee the highest number of indigenous peoples here. When we were in Dubai, we were celebrating 350 people in the Blue Zone. But in the end, we had like one indigenous for seven fossil fuel and mining lobbyists. So we were trying to work we are working harder to try to overcome the Dubai numbers so that we're more, we have one indigenous to each two lobbies of the fossil fuel and mining. So this distance, this gap is getting smaller. So we would like to overcome this and be the like the biggest participation in them.
It's not clear if it's as a result of the protests, but in the last few days, Brazil has recognized the indigenous land rights of in a way that it hadn't before. Do you think that is because of the protests that took place last week?
Bom, essa entrega é resultado de uma grande articulação do Ministério dos Povos Indígenas.
This announcement is the result of hard work and engagement of the Ministry of Indigenous Peoples and the FUNAI, the Indigenous Agents, so that we can come here with concrete results to show. Besides the land demarcation and titling, we also announced the commitment to protect and title 63 million hectares in their commitment, intergovernmental land commitment. And from these 63, 59 million hectares are lands that will be protected or titled by the Ministry of Indigenous Peoples, but we also have more power from the Ministry of Equality, Racial Equality. So all these lands that were announced yesterday is the result of the engagement and the coordination that the Ministry of Indigenous People has been doing internally in the government to have these results announced here.
Not long before the COP began, Brazilian President Lula approved oil drilling off the coast of the Amazon. He's been criticized by many environmentalists. Can you respond to this as his minister, his indigenous minister?
Primeiro, que não foi uma autorização para exploração do petróleo.
First, it's important to clarify that it's not the liberation for oil exploitation. Was the authorization for the studies to understand the impact of the oil exploration desire. So also it's important to say that Minister President Lula announced here the phase-out mapping for oil exploitation so that we could like create alternatives and phase out, because it's really common that sometimes oil will be like lacking from some cities, and there will not be any other alternatives for that communities to move. But then it's important to have a clear map and a clear actions so that we can diminish our dependency of the oil and look for other alternatives, and we are committed to that.
President Lula has also talked about a fossil fuel phase-out plan. Do you think this is possible, and what are the forces working against that?
É sempre desafio.
It's always a challenge. It's really, it's not simple, it's hard. Because there is a dispute, a big one, with the economic sectors so that this change do not happen. So we need to make sure that agreements done at COP and commitments done at COP can tackle this, because the world knows the impact that oil exploitation fossil fuels does, the risk of us achieving the point of no return. But these sectors, the economic sectors, need to understand this is an emergency. So we need to have like a clear decision here in this conference to stop depending on fossil fuel.
The violence against indigenous land defenders in Latin America is the worst in the world. I'm wondering how you think Lula is dealing with that, how you think it can be dealt with. The number of deaths continues as people try to protect the land. What measures have been taken?
Brazil has just launched a national plan for defenders, earth defenders. We are also working to approve the Escazú agreement passed by the House of Representatives and now is going to the Senate. We really think it is important that that will be also approved not only by the House of Representatives, but also the Senate. And there is a big effort of the Brazilian government and executive power to work to guarantee this approval. We also have a plan to combat the racism that is also being launched by the Brazilian government and a security, like a public security plan, because unfortunately we have in the indigenous territories 60% of the force of the justice, Minister Justice is there trying to combat violence and attacks in the indigenous territories, but we know that forces like the military forces or security is not the only way of combating the attacks. We need to get public policies to get into the territories, and advancing the demarcation is a way of doing this.
You and Alessandra Korab Munduruku and other indigenous leaders took on Bolsonaro in a big way. Can you talk about the significance of him being sentenced to decades in prison and what his presidency meant for Brazil, particularly indigenous people?
It was a really hard moment for indigenous peoples in Brazil. Together with the neglect and the offensive attack from Bolsonaro, we also had a pandemic where he not only neglected the pandemic, but also he was responsible for some measures that was against us. He attacked our rights, took our rights, so it was a very challenging and hard moment. We react, we organized, we were fundamental to be able to destroy fascism. So Bolsonaro now is judged and condemned, and we really expect that the justice will be done. And if he's sent to prison, we expect he will be paying for all his crimes. And that's what we expect, that justice can recognize, and so he can pay for everything he has done against us.
President Trump, the president of the United States, has increased the tariffs on Brazil until the case is dropped against Bolsonaro, the case against him attempting a coup against Lula in the same way that President Trump was accused of attempting a coup in the United States. What do you think of Trump demanding that Bolsonaro not go through the justice system, not be imprisoned?
This is unacceptable, and that's why President Lula was very firm, and he has a strong position to defend the sovereignty of our country and to strengthen our democracy. And the Brazilian people was together with him, besides him, supporting his position to defend our sovereignty.
I wanted to ask you about criticism of the COP being in Belém. On the one hand, it brings the world's focus to the gateway to the Amazon. On the other hand, people have said, you know, a four-lane highway was built that cut down some of the rainforest. What are your thoughts?
Eu acho que a primeira coisa é que escancarou um racismo muito grande da sociedade contra a Amazônia. Muita gente...
I think like the first important thing is that this just like show and like make it clear the environmental and the racism that we still have. People are saying that there's no condition for a COP to be able to be realized and organized here. And that was also fruit of prejudice against the people that live here. So beyond forest, people need to understand that we have a culture, we have people, and we have a diversity of people that protects the Amazon. So it's important that the world know that it's not only forests and animals that live in the Amazon, there are people living there, people that are being attacked, assaulted, they're having their rights violated, and that they need protection. On the other side, here in the Amazon, exists the needs and demands coming from the population of infrastructure, because in many places we have a very hard access. So who needs to say if there is bad or good impact? It's the people that live here.
That is Brazil's first minister of indigenous peoples, Sonia Guajajara, here at the UN Climate Summit, that's COP30, in the Brazilian city of Belém, the gateway to the Amazon. Next up, is the Amazon rainforest being pushed beyond the tipping point? We'll speak with the world-renowned Brazilian climatologist, Carlos Nobre. Stay with us.
La mujer del hombre pobre se conoce.
DemocracyNow.org. We're broadcasting at the UN Climate Summit, COP30, here in the Brazilian city of Belém, the gateway to the Amazon rainforest. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. As we broadcast, there's a protest right behind us by the Loss and Damage Youth Coalition, where they are holding a banner that reads, "From Opinion to Obligation, Respond to Loss and Damage."
We end today's show with one of Brazil's most prominent scientists, Dr. Carlos Nobre. He's a senior researcher at the Institute of Advanced Studies at the University of São Paulo and co-chair of the scientific panel for the Amazon. He's a lead author of the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, that won a Nobel Peace Prize in 2007 for its reports on global warming.
For decades, Carlos Nobre has been warning the Amazon rainforest is being pushed beyond the tipping point. The Amazon rainforest is almost as large as the contiguous United States. Carlos Nobre, welcome to Democracy Now! It's an honor to be in your presence. You have been warning for quite some time, and now it's getting more serious than ever. What is the tipping point? And for a lay audience around the world, explain to us why the biome of the Amazon rainforest is so important for the world.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Yes, I've been working for 43 years with the Amazon. I was the first scientist in 1990-1991 publishing science articles saying if we continue with very high deforestation, the Amazon would cross the tipping point. But that was 1990-1991, 36 years ago. Now the Amazon is very close to the tipping point. Why do we say that? Because from the Atlantic to Bolivia, Peru and Colombia, this is 2.5 million square kilometers. The whole forest close to 7 million square kilometers, but this southern portion, very close tipping point. The dry season is 4 to 5 weeks lengthier in 45 years, 1 week per decade. It was 3-4 months, but with rain during the dry season. Now it's 4 to 5 months, 20-30% drier, 2-3 degrees warmer. So, and also tree mortality has increased a lot in these areas. In the southeastern Amazon, south of where we are, the forest has become a carbon source. It's losing more carbon than removing. So if we continue, deforestation is about 18%, degradation 30%. If we reach 20-25% deforestation and global warming close to 2 degrees, we cross permanently the tipping point. We are going to lose up to 70% of the Amazon within 30 to 50 years. If we continue with global warming and deforestation, we reach tipping point by 2040. So by 2100, we're going to lose 70% of the Amazon. We'll release more than 250 billion tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, making it impossible to maintain the global warming at 1.5 degrees. We are going to lose the highest biodiversity in the planet. So terrible. And also, the Amazon recycles water so well that about 45% of the water vapor that comes from the Atlantic Ocean, transported by the trade winds, goes to the south of the Amazon and feeds more than 50% of rainfall on the tropical savanna south of the Amazon. So, and also the Atlantic rainforest. So it's really essential. If we lose the Amazon, not only the Amazon forest will disappear, but the tropical savanna as well.
So if you could also talk, Dr. Bnabre, in addition to increasing heat and the dryness that you talked about, you've also said that livestock grazing is a form of ecological pollution. Now, Brazil is the world's second largest producer of beef. If you could talk about what the impact of cattle ranching has been on this deforestation of the Amazon.
Yes, of course. I mean, 90% of the first deforestation in the lowlands in the Amazon in Brazil is related to cattle ranches. And when we compute, Brazil is the only country in the world where 70% of fossil fuel emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, come from land use change. About 70% of emissions, 40% deforestation, and about 20-25% this comes from agriculture, but mostly for cattle ranches. Particularly, the cattle emits a lot of methane. So all ruminants. So we say 55% of emissions in Brazil related to livestock, you know, the deforestation for cattle ranches and also the cattle emitting methane. So really we need urgently to get to zero deforestation in all Brazilian biomes, especially the Amazon, and also merging to the so-called regenerative livestock. Regenerative livestock, we have about 15% in Brazil of regenerative livestock, and very little. The regenerative livestock reduces a lot emissions by livestock.
And, you know, in Brazil, as you well know, Brazil is one of the world's largest agricultural exporters, which means the alternative that you mentioned may compensate, but presumably it would be a massive economic loss to Brazil if their agricultural production were to go down. But as you were mentioning earlier, though, there has been a commitment by countries here to work on a roadmap to get to zero deforestation by 2030. So there is an agreement there, whereas there's not a majority of countries signing up to the roadmap to phasing out fossil fuels. So if you could just talk about, I mean, the countries that are in part dependent on agricultural exports, what would it mean to diminish cattle ranching? And I mean, you've become, in fact, vegetarian as a result of this.
Oh, listen, mostly livestock average productivity is very low. Brazil has about 1.5 heads of cattle per hectare. This is very little. Brazil has about 3.2 million square kilometers, mostly livestock and also agricultural. So regenerative livestock will have 3 to 5 heads of cattle per hectare, reducing emission. And also the regenerative agriculture on livestock is much more resilient to the climate extremes. For instance, last year, Brazil had a record-breaking drought in the Amazon tropical savanna, Cerrado, and a record-breaking number decline of agricultural productivity. So, therefore, Brazil can continue being a tremendous high producer of meat, agricultural, soy grains, using not 3.2 million square kilometers, but maximum 2 million square kilometers.
I want to ask you a question about climate science. You have said that it's a mystery to you. The country which invested the most in climate science, a country with the largest number of climate scientists and very few who deny climate change, which contributed the most to the IPCC report. How is it possible this country elected a climate denier? And we're talking about the United States. But talk about the significance of the billions of dollars being removed from science research in the United States and the effect that has all over the world.
Well, that's a very good question, because in fact, I mean, I create a name, because all tipping points that we know in the climate, more than 20, they are all associated with ecological, biological, hydrological, ocean-related tipping points. But I think now the world in democracies, we are creating, I quote unquote, a social-political tipping point, which is, it's not only in the U.S. In many countries in the world, democracies, we are electing more and more populist politicians. U.S. President Trump, Argentina President Milei, Brazil elected former President Bolsonaro, totally climate denier. Deforestation increased a lot in those 4 years. That's happening all over the planet. So this is I even gave a name in the West. I said this social-political tipping point is the Trumping point. Why we are in democracies? As you mentioned, the country with the top science on climate change, U.S., always for decades. Why U.S. democracy electors are electing a climate denier president? This is very serious.
And you've said, Dr. Nobre, I mean, it's remarkable, as you said, with these right-wing governments being led in part by Donald Trump, the fact that this roadmap to deforestation was agreed. You've said that COP30 is a critical critical climate summit. Explain why and what you hope is going to come out of this. It's formally concluding tomorrow, but it regularly goes beyond that date.
Yes, that's a very good point, because all of us scientists, we say this COP30 has to be very important. I mean, as important as Paris Agreement, as important as COP26, when all countries agree in reducing emissions. But now we have to accelerate reducing emissions. Yesterday, we, the Planetary Science Pavilion people, we hand-deliver our declaration to all negotiators, and I hand-deliver to President Lula as well. We say, in addition to zero deforestation of all biomes, tropical forests, by 2030, we have to accelerate reducing of emissions by fossil fuels. We say, ideally, zero fossil fuel emissions by 2040, no longer than 2045. No questions, because the temperature is reaching 1.5 degrees within 5 to 10 years permanently. If we only get to net zero emissions by 2050, we may reach 2 degrees and even more. It will be a tragedy, an ecocide for the planet. And when I present this document to President Lula, he said, also four times he said, I was in a meeting with him, he said, this has to be the most important COP of all COPs. Let's hope in 2 days now, countries will agree not only zero deforestation of tropical forests by 2030, but zero fossil fuel emissions by 2040.
We want to thank you so much. Carlos Nobre, leading Brazilian scientist, world-renowned climatologist, senior researcher at the Institute of Advanced Studies at the University of Sao Paulo, co-chair of the scientific panel for the Amazon, where we are right now. We're in Belém, the gateway of the Amazon. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Hey, this is Nate Bright, co-producing of this year's CFNC Live Sessions and release rating reels on Instagram. Do you love local music and supporting local arts? CFNC's annual funding drive is running until December 30th.